Page 380. Critical theory concerns with mediating subjectivity was not limited to the sciences. Of course, through the illusion of value neutrality, made them a particularly tempting and fruitful field in which to demonstrate the operation of tacit consensus and presuppositions concerning with the emergence of production of knowledge and orientations for political reasons. Horkheimer very early gave primacy to the relations between base and superstructure, so neglected by Marx himself. The investigations were to be empirical and methodical, to detect the actual psychic links between mind and reality. Footnote 38, text. When Horkheimer assumed the direction of the Institute, he outlined the changed focus on his inaugural speech to put a comprehensive empirical research apparatus into the service of problems of social philosophy, the central one being the connection between the economic life of society, the psychic development of individuals, and the changes in cultural spheres, including not only the intellectual content of the sciences, art, and religion, but of law, morals, fashion, public opinion, sports, entertainment, lifestyle, and so on. Footnote 39, text. It went without saying that such a comprehensive project necessitated an interdisciplinary approach simply because the nature of the object in which the various spheres overlapped demanded it. In a sense, one could say that the historical materialist grounding of the constitution problem, that is, what constituted the objects of our perception, judgment, and action, was the central methodological concern of critical theory. Footnote 40, text. According to Habermas, the first critical philosopher was Kant, rather than merely systematize the substance of knowledge. Kant focused on the conditions of knowing, that there were not only distortions of truth, as Bacon had suggested with his notion of idols, but conditions of truth, that is, regulative ideas and categorical forms through which and only through which we perceive sense data as particular objects or events. This discovery had been one of Kant's chief merits. In principle, we never see or know objects as they really are, but only as they are constituted through these filtering and ordering forms. Traditional theories, on the whole, critical theorists pointed out, tended to repeat Kant's mistake about these subjective conditions of knowledge in its hypostasis as forms of knowledge, seemingly containing no substantive assertions. The collective subjectivity forgets how and whereby it was constituted. Footnote 41, text. Kant, though, had simply preserved a truth of an age prior to his own. He attributed to the subjective forms of knowledge, the immutability traditionally ascribed the objects themselves. After Kant, however, this naivete was no longer justifiable, and critical theorists chided the objectivistic illusion of recent positivism, which request to pre-Kantian certainties about a reality per se, or to the Kantian notion of cognitive forms valid a priori. Page 381. This general subjectivity upon which individual knowledge depends, footnote 42, text, described by Kant as timeless and fixed, is literally invisible in its form as common sense. As a condition in form of knowledge, it rarely becomes an object of knowledge. Yet these self-evident axioms of everyday practice constitute the most important dimensions of an ideology. Universally shared, these frameworks of our knowledge do not appear as relative or contingent. Because of this universality, they do in fact constitute the spirit, the truth of a group, no matter how historically relative and limited this spirit and group actually is. While these tacit and allegedly formed axioms, this framework literally delimits what can be seen and what is conceivable, it nevertheless constitutes the logic in use of that age or group, and thus is logic per se for that age or group. In this sense, an ideology is simply the common sense of a given reference group. From Bacon through de Holbach to Daniel Bell, ideologies have been mostly seen as distortions of and barriers to an actual truth. The critical concept of ideology and myth emphasizes their truth as well as their concealing function, that is, concealing their contingency, in one of his earliest works. Horkheimer had praised Vico for his insight that the oldest legends must have contained political truth. Footnote 43, text. To be sure, the limit of what we can rightfully call ideology is itself set by the present stage of our knowledge. Footnote 44, text. That is, the historical contingency of knowledge and ideology are two different things. That mores have the status of facts, to use Sumner's formulation, implies the facts both carry and represent the current truth and at the same time conceal it. By concealing the active social and historical dimension behind the neutral facade of factuality, likewise, Marcuse had chided the academic sociology of knowledge for concerning itself only with the untruth, but not with the truth of forms of consciousness. It would be difficult to comprehend this argument without the concomitant Hegelian concept of reason. Not a timeless human faculty hovering over the vicissitudes of history and the object world, reason, in this version, is a historical function, the dawning stage of awareness, the current comprehension, conceptualization of the way human experiences themselves. Myths, for instance, are objectifications of reason in this sense. The first attempts of humans to deal with themselves in object form. Of course, gods are false consciousness, but their truth is not in their manifest content. As anthropomorphism, they allow confrontation with human attributes, which necessitates reasons for favoring these attributes rather than others. While they are false consciousness, they also therefore contains this emancipatory truth. Page 382. Neo-romantic ideologies are wrong and stupid in their explicit content, but have their truth content in their keen reaction to alienating and authoritarian forms of life. The latest stage of such reason always tends to appear absolute, universal, and natural simply because it does not yet include awareness of its own limits and functions. Such awareness would mean that this consciousness or reasons had moved to a higher stage of self-awareness, that it had recognized its particular form as one, not the mode of conceptualizing experience and observation. In retrospect, we can always recognize previous forms of reason as limited, but to call them false implies they were unnecessary detours. The working reasons or working truth of an age or culture cannot just have been false as long as it was necessary stage. For all its teleological substratum, this concept of necessary illusions transcends the simple-minded notion of truth as existing out there, ready-made, already coined, as Hegel used to say, patiently waiting to be discovered. If we could just make up our minds to shed false notions and approaches. Such truth is more disastrous than error and ignorance because it paralyzes the forces with which one works toward enlightenment and knowledge. Footnote 45, text. Nietzsche had once complained, truth might be more usefully conceptualized as a force of production, for in this manner it includes its development and function as part of his substance. A ready truth would entail an ontology of the world as fixed and final, and thus entail a fatalistic ideology. By contrast, for instance, even Fichte's false idealistic insistence on the active transcendental subject made it possible to historize the constitution problem. Consequently, at that time, it was the only way to conceptualize consciousness as praxis, and praxis as the categorical constitution of the world, for example, through labor. That people can perceive their consciousness as contingent, that is, that myth can turn into enlightenment, was one of the central contentions of dialectic of enlightenment. However socially conditioned the thinking of the individuals may be, it remains the thought of individuals who are not merely the products of collective processes, but also make these processes the object of their thought. Footnote 46, text. Horkheimer still asserts at the end of his life that the viewpoint from which this is done is promptly mythified, fetishized. In turn, was the other side of the dialectic, the very act of liberation reverts into heteronomy, again enlightenment into myth. Page 383. A consistently non-a priori approach must distrust any first, final, or immutable principles, be they substantive, structural, formal, or teleological. Footnote 47, text. Much to the chagrin of more orthodox Marxists, this prevented critical theorists from fetishizing even the economic base or any social objectivity, and even the critique of political economy as a theory to them. It remained a form of historical reason. A great truth wants to be criticized, not idealized. Nietzsche had proclaimed, and he was fondly cited by critical theorists who insisted that the influence of social development on the structure of the theory is part of the theory's substantive content. Footnote 48, text. The function of a theory was very much part of the validity of its truth claim. Given the evolution of productive forces of antiquity, even the materialistic philosophers were forced in the face of suffering to elaborate techniques of an anterior life. Peace of soul is the only resort in the midst of distress when all external means fail. by contrast, the materialism of the early bourgeois era aimed at developing the knowledge of nature and attaining new powers of mastery over nature and man. The misery of the present, however, is linked to the structure of society. Social theory, therefore, constitutes the content of contemporary